This is session 709, the Insular Records for the Unincorporated, Archiving the Historical Record of U.S. Territories. And we realize that you are in the last panel session of the last day of a four-day conference, and so we appreciate all of your stamina and your interest, and I assure you your efforts will not go unrewarded. For the record, because this is being recorded, my name is not Basil C. Otley, Jr. Basil serves as the Virgin Islands Desk Officer for the Department of Interior, and over 9 months ago had generously agreed to serve as this panel's moderator. But we all know what the federal government is like, right? In June of this year, the Department of Interior decided there was a greater need for the VI territorial desk officer to be on site in the Virgin Islands and not in D.C. And as a result, Basil was suddenly unavailable to serve and moderate this panel and offer his professional observations on the historical records of U.S. territories. Basil, who is a native Virgin Islander, would also have offered his personal reflections on cultural identity and the long-term effects of isolating a community from its colonial-based records. So, for the record, my name is Susan Laura Lugo, and I will be serving as moderator today. I'm a certified archivist, and I have served as the archivist for the territorial government of the U.S. Virgin Islands since 2008. I hold a master's in library and information science from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and I am the immediate past chair of the Latin American and Caribbean Cultural Heritage Archives Roundtable. I'm also a co-founder of the Caribbean Genealogy Library on the island of St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands, and I serve on the steering committee of the Genealogy and Local History section of the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions. As a 33-year resident of the Virgin Islands and married into a seventh, at least that's how far we've documented, seventh generation Virgin Islands West Indian family, I can offer you this. In my professional role as an archivist, I have witnessed firsthand the confusion and consternation of a community distanced or cut off from its documentary heritage. As a genealogist, I have also witnessed the personal struggles of descendants of colonial, enslaved, and native populations to discover their personal identities in the hidden histories of colonial government record-keeping. The experts we have assembled here today will speak to you not only of these challenges, but also of the practical issues surrounding the care, custody, and control of records in times of transition and times of reflection. You will hear about records of safeguarded but not used. You will hear about records alienated and returned, and records at risk. Throughout these presentations, a common thread you will want to consider is the theme of access and ownership. So let us begin. It's my pleasure to introduce the panel to you. Each speaker will make a presentation, and we will ask you to hold your comments or questions until the end. But you are encouraged to question, and through your comments, you are encouraged to make us think as well. Dr. Vernon Paul Rood has been an archivist with the National Archives since 1988, and presently he works out of the Archives 2 facility in College Park, Maryland. He attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he earned both his PhD and an MALS. From 2001 to 2008, Paul also served as NARA's specialist for Danish language Virgin Islands records. He has authored several publications significant to Virgin Islanders, including A Finding Aid for Danish Language Virgin Islands Records, and three narrow microfilm publications for a series on Danish West Indian records for the Virgin Islands. These titles include Narrow Microfilm Series M1883, Selected Records of the Danish West Indies, 1672 to 1917, Essential Records, Concerning Slavery and Emancipation, which was produced in 2002, and Nara Microfilm Series M1884, selected records of the Danish West Indies, 1672 to 1917, records with genealogical value, produced in 2004. Dr. Boot has been an ardent supporter for increasing access to these records and will speak to you today about his efforts in that regard. Thomas F. Cotter is a senior records analyst for the Life Cycle Management Division of the National Archives and Records Administration, and his office, too, is at Archives 2 in College Park, Maryland. Tom has been with the National Archives since 1992 and has served in several capacities. He was educated at the University of Baltimore. He was the archivist for NARA on the Transition Commission for the transfer of the canal from almost the inception of his employment at NARA for the better part of the following 8 years, and the inestimable value of the work of his team in that effort has been acknowledged by others, including in the USAID publication, A Strategy for Preserving the Information Resources of the Panama Canal. Tom's firsthand experiences with the records of the Panama Canal Zone Commission have been shared in the past with other groups, including at the Mid-Atlantic Region Archives Conference in 2005. And today we are so grateful that he is not hiking the Appalachian Trail today and that he can be with us to share his perspectives on the repatriation of documents for a former U.S. territory. It took me 2.5 weeks to get him to sign on to this panel because he was hiking the Appalachian Trail and nobody could get in touch with him. Bienvenidos a Milagros Pepin Rivera, who has been an archivist since 1994 with the Archivo General de Puerto Rico, which is organized under and reports to the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture. In addition to her archival duties, Milagros has served as cultural affairs specialist with the Puerto Rico Archives since 2000. She has also worked as a reference archivist in the main reference room, archivist for the Still Images Division, and as a coordinator for grant-funded projects in Puerto Rico. In 2000, she also found time to earn a certificate in administration of documents and archives from the University of Puerto Rico Graduate School of Information Sciences. We are very pleased that she has come so far to lend a Puerto Rican voice to these discussions. Her paper will be presented on the Archives of Puerto Rico, its relationship to the administration and disposition of public documents of the island, the resources of the archives, and the challenges it faces. The U.S. Virgin Islands, the Panama Canal Zone, and the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, unincorporated territories all with insular records, stories hidden, history removed and relocated, and information at risk. Dr. Rood?
I have a couple of these publications. I'll just pass them around. There's also a handout at the door on the Virgin Islands microfilming project, both the ones completed and the ones projected. And you're all free to help yourselves to a copy of that as well. I'll give you first a bit of a geographical and historical context of the Virgin Islands. Can you hear me all the way in the back? Everything's clear? Okay. The Virgin Islands refers to two small groups of islands that lie east of Puerto Rico, about 1,100 miles southeast of Miami. They are situated between the Atlantic Ocean to the north and the Caribbean Sea to the south. One group of these islands, which is called the U.S. Virgin Islands, consists of three main islands, St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix, as well as some nearby islets. The other group is called the British Virgin Islands and is still a possession of Great Britain. These islands were the products of volcanic action. The excellent natural harbor of St. Thomas is the sunken crater of a long-extinct volcano. The Virgin Islands lie along the same geological fault line that resulted in the devastating earthquake in Haiti earlier this year. Along this fault line also lie a number of other similar volcanic islands that are known as the Lesser Antilles. Volcanoes, earthquakes, and tsunamis are facts of life in this part of the world, as are the annual hurricanes. These islands lie in the tropics, but the temperatures are moderated by their location in the ocean. The average annual temperature on St. Thomas is a balmy 78 degrees. Many of these islands are covered by tropical jungle-like vegetation. The modern history of the Virgin Islands begins with Christopher Columbus, who was the first European to see them in 1493 on his second voyage to the New World. When he saw these innumerable dots of green in the broad blue ocean, he named them after St. Ursula and her 11,000 martyred virgins, thus the Virgin Islands. Over the next centuries, five of the European powers, Spain, France, England, the Netherlands, and Denmark, staked claims to islands in the Caribbean. All five of these European states decided upon the same method of making these islands economically viable. They grew sugarcane on them, which was made into sugar, molasses, and rum. In like manner, all five of these European states imported slaves from Africa to work the sugarcane plantations. In time, all of those peoples either threw off slavery or were granted their freedom. Today, the vast majority of the people on these islands are descended from the slaves. In the year 1672, Denmark established a settlement on the island of St. Thomas. In 1718, Denmark claimed nearby St. John, and in 1733, it purchased the island of St. Croix from France. Together, these three islands became known as the Danish West Indies. As on the other islands in the Caribbean, the Danes based the economy of these islands on slave labor working plantations of sugarcane. In addition, the excellent port on St. Thomas was an important market and transshipment point. The economic foundations of this Danish establishment were overthrown on July 3, 1848, when a massive slave uprising on St. Croix caused the Danish governor, Peter von Scholten, to grant all islanders their immediate freedom. Since that date, July 3rd has been known in these islands as Emancipation Day, and it is a national holiday. The emancipation of the slaves was only the first of several civil disturbances, the most serious of which was the so-called fire burn of 1878, when some plantations on St. Croix were burned. By then, the sugarcane industry was declining in profitability, and the islands had become a financial burden to Denmark. Beginning in the 1860s, there were intermittent diplomatic negotiations between Denmark and the United States concerning the possible sale and transfer of the islands. Finally, a treaty was agreed on in late 1916, according to which the United States purchased the islands from Denmark for the sum of $25 million, which in today's money would be about $450 million. At the time, the United States was concerned mainly to obtain the port of St. Thomas to use as a naval base to protect the Panama Canal. Since 1917, Transfer Day, March 31st, has also been a holiday in the Virgin Islands, particularly because the transfer was so much welcomed by the islanders. It should be noted here that few of the Virgin Islanders ever learned Danish. Certainly, they almost all spoke English following a period of English rule during the Napoleonic Wars. Perhaps contributing to this development was the close proximity of the British Virgin Islands. Certainly, the fact that the Virgin Islanders generally spoke English simplified considerably their assimilation to American culture. At the same time, they have retained their separate identity as Virgin Islanders and as members of a Commonwealth of the United States. Part 2, the records of the U.S. Virgin Islands, history, nature, and extent. As you noted from the previous section, the history of the U.S. Virgin Islands can be divided into two main periods, the Danish era, 1672 to 1917, and the U.S. era, 1917 to the present. In like fashion, the records are also divided into those two major groups, the pre-1917 records, which are almost entirely in the Danish language, and the post-1917 records, which are in English. These records are divided not only by language, but also by their three separate current locations, Denmark, the United States, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. First of all, the records in Denmark. The Danes were obsessive record keepers, and over the centuries they created huge quantities of records, many of which they preserved. The majority of these records ended up in the Danish National Archives, the Rigsarkiv in Copenhagen. They fill about 1,500 meters of shelving. If we apply standard measurements to this amounts to at least 4,500 cubic feet of records, which at 2,500 pages per cubic foot totals over 11 million pages of records. However, this figure can only be offered as a very rough approximation of the extent of the records. The records in Copenhagen document the following major groups: Danish colonial administration, the records of the Danish trading companies, and many of the oldest records concerning local administration in the islands. A new comprehensive guide to these records was issued by the Rigsarkiv in 2001, and in 2002 appeared as an English translation. Many of these records were in Denmark from the beginning, but a number were shipped there from the Virgin Islands following the transfer of the records, the islands to the United States according to mutual agreement. The last of these shipments was made in 1921. It should be noted that not only are these documents in Danish, but also they were written in the Gothic script, which was a variation of the Latin alphabet that was almost universally used in northern Germany and Scandinavia from about the 16th to the early 20th centuries. The prevalence of the Gothic script was a sign of the close cultural affinity between northern Germany and Scandinavia at that time. The Gothic script used in the German and the Scandinavian languages was virtually identical, only the languages differed. For today's reader, the Gothic script presents formidable difficulties. Today, even native speakers of the Scandinavian languages and German often need to learn the Gothic script through university courses or online. Even then, the average reader will require months, if not years, in becoming comfortable at reading it. Thus, the potential researcher in these records must not only obtain excellent reading ability in Danish, but also in the Gothic script. Second part, records in the United States. In the 1930s, the then-new National Archives sent an archivist to the Virgin Islands who could read Danish. His name was Dr. Harold Larsen. He selected records and organized shipments of them from the Virgin Islands to the National Archives in 1937. Years later, he returned and arranged shipments in 1954 and 55. The net effect of his efforts was as follows: about 2,300 cubic feet of Danish language records, estimated at least 4 million pages, and about 258 cubic feet of English language records from the years 1917 to 1950. Regarding first the Danish era records, the oldest among them date from 1672, making them over one century older than the oldest U.S. federal records, which date from 1774, the First Continental Congress. The bulk of the Danish records date from the 19th century, especially the decades after the emancipation of 1848. They mainly document local government on the islands, especially local governing bodies, judiciary and courts, police and jails, service agencies like roads and streets, welfare agencies, among others. Archivists in both Copenhagen and Washington are agreed that there is little overlap among these records. There is possibly some overlap in the voluminous correspondence that went on between the local administration and the home government in Denmark, with some drafts of letters together with copies and notations possibly existing in both places. On the whole, however, these are two separate and distinct bodies of Danish language records. The Danish language records in Washington were first described in an informal typewritten guide in 1961 by a National Archives employee named H. Don Hooker. It is not known whether Mr. Hooker knew Danish, although one suspects from the mistakes made in the guide that he was not master of the language. He does not mention whether or to what extent he based his descriptions on the previous work of Dr. Harold Larsen. Dr. Larsen's handwritten notes, descriptions, and translations are still found throughout the records. In any case, Mr. Hooker's 1961 guide was uneven in its description. Some records were described very minutely. Many others, however, were shunted into two large miscellaneous series that comprised several hundred cubic feet. The same Mr. Hooker also produced a much more thorough and useful guide to the English language records in the custody of the National Archives dated 1917 to 1950. This guide was published in 1960 and is still used. Let us fast forward to the year 1998 and the celebrations of the 150th anniversary of slave emancipation in the Danish West Indies. One consequence of the event was the signing in the following year of an agreement between Denmark and the U.S. Virgin Islands to cooperate in making the records of the islands more accessible. The U.S. National Archive joined this endeavor in 2000. In 2001, the management of the National Archives decided that these records should be redescribed, an effort that took place in parallel with the Danish National Archives. Since I was one of only two people in the agency who could read Danish, the other one was in the presidential library system and now works at the Eisenhower Library in Kansas, I was given the job of making the new guide. I estimated that I needed about 2 years to produce a new guide. In the end, however, I was given only about 4 or 5 months. Because of the short amount of time available, I found it necessary to reuse the 1961 guide as a template. I began to describe more thoroughly the records in the large miscellaneous series, but time constraints prevented this work from being finished. Today, the records of these two large miscellaneous series remain, by and large, described and processed at only a rudimentary level. In any case, a few photocopies of my new guide were bound when work ended on it at the end of 1901. It is a guide shown to researchers today. This guide has also been posted on the Danish National Archives website for Virgin Islands records. Next, records in the Virgin Islands. As far as I know, there's no comprehensive guide to records in the Virgin Islands. However, we can make some inferences about them. First of all, some records were never removed from the Virgin Islands, such as land records and titles to deeds and property, which were necessary to establish property rights. Second, all records since 1950 are still in the islands to the extent that they still exist. Third, the situation is changing. There is an increasing awareness in the islands about the records and the need to preserve them. One sign of this was the recent appointment of a territorial archivist for the islands, Ms. Susan Lugo, who has brought a new level of professionalism to the islands. Third part, Virgin Islands Microfilm Project. In early 2002, I was tasked with creating microfilm editions of some of these Danish language records. However, it was decided by the management of the National Archives that it was not economically feasible to microfilm all 5 million pages of records from the Virgin Islands. Instead, it was decided that I should determine the most important Danish language records, and we would microfilm only those. As a consequence, I developed a microfilming plan that included only the 1.3 million pages that I thought were especially important. Later, it was decided to microfilm also the 600,000 pages of English language records dated 1917 to 1950 in their entirety. The projected total for this microfilming project was thus to be about 2 million pages, or about 40% of the total body of Virgin Islands records in the custody of the National Archives. My task was to prepare the records for microfilming. I was to be assigned an archives technician to proofread the microfilm as it emerged from the microfilming laboratory. A schedule is established according to which the whole project would be completed in about 6 years, that is by about 2008. However, in the end, and after many vicissitudes, the project was stopped by the management of the National Archives in 2008, with only about 140,000 pages microfilmed, or only about 7% of the plan's total. Because I'm still employed at the National Archives, I can say no more about this matter. Since April 2008, that is for over 2 years, no further work has been done on these records, and I have been reassigned to work with ordinary federal records. While it lasted, however, the microfilming project achieved the following things. One, the publication in 2002 of the first microfilm publication, Essential Records Concerning Slavery and Emancipation, 11 rolls of microfilm. The publication 2004 of the second microfilm publication, Records with Genealogical Value, 130 rolls. The processing of about a third of a million pages of records for a third microfilm publication titled provisionally Records Concerning Politics, Law, and Diplomacy. I completed processing these records in April 2008, but the records were not allowed to go forward to microfilming. Instead, they have remained on the shelves in the processing room where they left them in filming order. Recently, they were moved to the stack, still in their filming order. This is an important publication. One, it includes the oldest records that date back to 1672. Two, it includes records that document the political evolution of the islands after emancipation. Three, many of these political records are in bilingual texts, Danish and English, so that scholars without extensive Danish language skills can make use of them. It is to be hoped that the management of the National Archives eventually allows these significant records to be microfilmed. And lastly, then, the future of the Virgin Islands records. It appears fairly certain that many of them will eventually make their way back to the Virgin Islands in some form or other. At the National Archives, the working assumption has been that the records should be microfilmed as a preliminary step to repatriating them to the Virgin Islands. There is even talk of repatriating the records from Denmark. In archival terms, microfilm copies of originals are the best long-term solution to preserving these records. In the meantime, digital copies of these records may be made. The basic precondition for repatriating the records is to build a new state-of-the-art facility, archival facility in the Virgin Islands. In sum, the situation regarding the records of the Virgin Islands is in flux, along with some uncertainty about their future. However, the great value of these records is indisputable, and in the future they will be seen as valuable documentation about life in the Caribbean. I have a few more slides here that I'll show, and my special thanks to Susan Lugo, both for making this presentation possible and also for furnishing about the final two-thirds of these pictures. Okay, here's St. Thomas. On a clear day, you can see the outline of St. Croix from this height, about 30 miles?
Just
40 miles, right.
See all the cruise ships?
Yeah, the cruise ships come in there every day and dock. And that's the city of Charlotte Amalia down there, which is the capital of the Virgin Islands, named after a Danish queen. Here is Dronningen's Gate. They still call it. It's Queen Street. They still use the Danish, which is the main street in Charlotte Amalia. And that's the Baal Library on the left, which is the main archival repository. The archival records are on the bottom floor. The main floor is the research room reference, and the top floor is where the microfilming facility is. Okay, here's, yeah, the front entrance then of the Baal Library. The back entrance. That's your former boss back there. Mm-hmm. Forgotten her name.
We'll go there.
Oh, okay. Okay. And this is the entrance and the researchers go. And this is, it gives you an idea of what the Danish Gothic handwriting looks like. It's Danish, but it's in this old Gothic script in which N's and E's and R's look all about the same. F's and S's are about the same. And the handwritten is very different from the printed Gothic even. And here we have the Danish National Archives website for the Danish West Indies Islands records, and the finding aid that I made for these records in 2001 is posted on this website. And there's the URL if you want to check it out. You just go to the Danish National Archives. You can Google Danish National Archives and find it also. So this is the the finding aid. And here's the our website for Danish National or for the Danish records. And this is a very unusual descriptive mode here because nobody in our agency uses these numbers, these decimals. This was created kind of for a finding aid that they made. And in fact, people in reference are flummoxed all the time when people check the website and come in with these decimal numbers, which they tried to create them totally separate from any established finding aids, okay, so that they'd be sort of more eternal or something, I guess. But, whatever. And that's me. Susan took this picture there. This is in the stacks with the Virgin Islands records in their boxes. A lot of them still in FRCs. We'd like to rebox. We'd like to finish that sort of holdings maintenance. Many, many volumes. These are kind of like the computer hard drives of the 18th and 19th centuries, you know. Each year they'd open up a new ledger book for whatever office they were dealing with. 5 million pages. Here's the first microfilm publication, Slavery and Emancipation. The slavery records are very important. UNESCO has listed anything relating to the human slave trade or human slavery as World Heritage records. And the genealogical records they use a lot. And I'll answer questions afterwards.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you're all enjoying your visit to the nation's capital. There's so much to see here and explore. And what I'd like to talk about today is the records of the former Panama Canal Zone. And like Paul, I also work for the National Archives and Records Administration. I'm an appraisal archivist with the Life Cycle Management Division. And I've been with the agency since 1992. And when I first arrived at the National Archives, my supervisor actually called me into his office one day and he said, "Tom, have I got a project for you?" So the Panama Canal Commission is going out of business in 7 years, and they have requested our assistance in the proper disposition of its records. And he went on to emphasize how important the assignment was because, as he put it, any historical records not coming out of Panama by the end of 1999, when the actual canal changes legal custody from the U.S. government to the Republic of Panama, those records won't be coming out. And this was based on a 1977 treaty between the United States and Panama. It's called the Carter-Torrijos Treaty, whereby the United States was turning over legal custody and stewardship of the Panama Canal to the Republic of Panama on December 31st, 1999. Well, you can imagine, my first reaction would have been sheer panic. Just great, I thought. Here I am, new to the agency, and being handed responsibility for a major project like this. Well, for the next 7 years, and with the assistance of dedicated individuals at the Panama Canal Commission, I successfully completed the project. And as a result of the project, over 25 records retention schedules providing for the appropriate disposition of all Panama Canal records were approved by the Archivist of the United States. And the schedules provided for, first of all, they provided for the transfer of historical records documenting the construction, maintenance, and administration of the canal by the U.S. government over the last 75 years. Secondly, the schedules arranged for the destruction of records that were lacking historical or archival value that were no longer needed for government business, for ongoing business of canal operations. And third, the schedules also provided for copies of records that were needed for ongoing operations by the Republic of Panama. Now, before I discuss the issues with the project, let me first provide everyone here with some historical background about the construction of the Panama Canal and the U.S. involvement in Panama. There are a few engineering marvels wrought by man that capture the imagination of the Panama Canal. The only things that come close are the celebrated pyramids of Egypt and the Great Wall of China. The Panama Canal was built by sheer ingenuity of man. It was the culmination of a 400-year-old dream to join the world's two great oceans dating back to 1513, when Vasco de Balboa first crossed the Isthmus of Panama. No attempt was ever made to turn this dream into reality until 1882, when the Compagnie Nouvelle du Canal de Panama, pardon my French, a private French company, began their efforts to build a sea-level canal. Now, the French labored over 20 years, and disease and financial problems eventually defeated them. The United States became interested in building a canal across the isthmus in 1902 when Congress passed the Spooner Act. The Spooner Act actually authorized President Theodore Roosevelt to purchase at a cost of $40 million the assets of the failed French company. And Roosevelt was very eager to enact this because he had always dreamed about a canal crossing the Isthmus of Panama for not only economic reasons and financial reasons for trade, but I think his primary concern was for military purposes. Roosevelt, as you know, had served in the Spanish-American War, and he was very upset that it took so long to get the U.S. fleet from the Atlantic side of the United States around the Cape of Good Hope, and into the Pacific. So Roosevelt was very eager to have this canal built. Now, in 1904, the governments of the United States and Panama entered into an agreement granting the U.S. the occupation, use, and control of a 10-mile-wide strip of land running across the 50-mile isthmus of Panama. And the U.S. took possession of the land that same year and began construction of the canal under the auspices of the newly created Isthmian Canal Commission, or the ICC, as it was known at the time. To build the canal, the ICC knew that it had to succeed in areas where the French had failed. With the latest medical and sanitary techniques, it first conquered the disease problem that had killed many French workers. Malaria, yellow fever, dengue fever, it was just decimating the ranks of the French workers. And after accomplishing the sanitary and health problems, the ICC then turned its attention to the engineering problems in building the canal. Of many lessons learned from the French mistakes, perhaps the most important was the need to get the canal in harmony with nature. Instead of digging a sea level canal, the U.S. engineers adopted a plan that the French had rejected. And this plan was they were dam the Chagres River that flows across the isthmus. And this actually created a high-level Gatun, what they refer to as the Gatun Lake. It's a man-made lake that, and using giant locks as water stairways to move ships up and down from the lake and across the isthmus. In addition to constructing the largest earthen dam ever created at the time, U.S. engineers also excavated an 8-mile cut through the Continental Divide and designated and built the most expensive canal locks ever envisioned and constructed the largest gates ever swung. Completion of the canal occurred in August of 1914, thus fulfilling the centuries-old dream of uniting the world's two great oceans and establishing a new link in the global transportation chain. It took 400 years, several tries, and some politics before human effort and technology would catch up with this romantic dream to conquer 50 miles of volcanic mountains of hard rock, impenetrable jungle, hot sun averaging 80 degrees Fahrenheit annually, overwhelming humidity, almost like Washington this week, torrential rainfall averaging 105 inches per year, devastating floods, mud and earth slides, and deep swamps that harbored mosquitoes carrying diseases like yellow fever and malaria. As daunting as the task was, it took the United States 10 years, the labor force of more than 75,000 men and women, and almost $400 million to complete. The greater cost was the death toll that will never really be known, but it is estimated that 25,000 people died building the Panama Canal. Now, in 1950, once the canal was completed and several years later, in 1950, Congress passed an act establishing what they called the Canal Zone Government and the Panama Canal Company. The Canal Zone Government controlled the civil government of the canal, while the Panama Canal Company was assigned the responsibility of the administration, operation, and maintenance of the canal. The governor of the Canal Zone also served as the president of the Panama Canal Company. The decades of the 1950s and 1960s were characterized by increased political agitation and violent demonstrations in Panama, with protesters demanding that U.S. recognition of Panamanian sovereignty over the canal zone. Years of complicated negotiations ensued between the United States and the Republic of Panama, culminating in the 1977 Carter-Torrijos Treaty, which I had alluded to earlier, and it was signed by President Jimmy Carter and Panamanian President Omar Torrijos. The treaty, ratified by the U.S. Senate on April 18, 1978, guaranteed that the Republic of Panama would take legal custody and control of the Panama Canal at noon on December 31, 1999. In order to carry out the responsibilities of the U.S. government with respect to the treaty, Congress established the Panama Canal Commission in 1979. Many of the civil functions formerly handled by the Canal Zone Government, that is the police, fire department, fire protection, sanitation, were all turned over to the Panamanian government. The Panama Canal Commission, or PCC, however, continued to manage, operate, and maintain the canal, its complementary works, installations, equipment, and provided for an orderly transit of vessels until December 31, 1999, when the canal was officially transferred to the government of Panama. What I want to discuss now is some of the major issues involving the Panama Canal record scheduling project. In 1979, in preparation for a smooth transfer of the canal, The newly created Panama Canal Commission recognized a need to address record scheduling issues. Therefore, PCC initiated an effort to determine the proper disposition of all federal records that had been accumulating in Panama over the years. PCC then commenced an agency-wide records inventory. This resulted in the development of 10 records retention schedules arranged organizationally covering many series of records that had accumulated within the various offices of the agency. PCC subsequently submitted these records retention schedules to and received the approval of the Archivist of the United States. Although U.S. government agencies can propose records disposition, only the Archivist of the United States can approve the disposition of federal records. In 1992, 13 years after the National Archives had approved the schedules, two things became apparent to PCC and to NARA. First, the existing schedules needed updating because many of the civil functions had transferred from the Canal Zone government to the government of Panama. Secondly, many of the agency's potentially permanent records were missed during the original inventory and therefore remained unscheduled. And consequently, PCC made a concerted effort to remedy the situation. With time running out, for the next 7 years, PCC embarked on an agency-wide records inventory and scheduling project. Under the direction of the agency's Office of Executive Administration and Transitions Coordination Records Management Branch, 25 PCC employees representing every bureau and division were assigned the task of carrying out the complete records inventory. These employees were selected on the basis of their familiarity with the records in the operations within their respective bureaus and divisions. Conducted over a 7-month period, the inventory identified all records in all media formats, including electronic records. Working in 5 teams, the employees visited all offices and the agency record center to identify and describe the program records unique to each bureau, as well as the general administrative records. From the information they collected, each team wrote descriptions on each record series inventory. Personnel from the records management branch then met with program managers to determine retention requirements for these series. Using the results of the inventory, PCC's records management branch divided the records into 4 different categories. First, records no longer required for future canal operations by the government of Panama, but they lacked historical value. This group of records would be scheduled for immediate destruction. Secondly, records required for future canal operations by the government of Panama, but lacked historical value. Wait, let me go back here. Records required for future canal operations, but lacked historical value. This group of records would be scheduled to remain in Panama. Third, records no longer required for future canal operations, but contained historical value. This group of records will be scheduled to be transferred to the National Archives. And fourth, records required for future canal operations, but contain historical value as well. This group of records needed to be duplicated, with a copy remaining in Panama and the original records being transferred to the National Archives. At the conclusion of the project, PCC submitted 26 records retention schedules totaling 787 series to the National Archives for approval. Now, as the NARA appraisal archivist assigned to PCC, I worked closely with several of the PCC records management staff in obtaining approval for these approved schedules, proposed schedules. And as I mentioned earlier, time was running out. Time was crucial at this point. The records documenting the history of the United States government involvement in Panama and continual control over the canal needed to be shipped out by the end of 1999. Consequently, I made several trips to Panama between 1993 and 1997. I examined the records, speaking with knowledgeable PCC personnel about the records, and making appraisal decisions regarding each series reviewed. Each schedule required an appraisal report and recommendations to the Archivist of the United States as to the appropriate disposition of each series of records. NARA and the Archivist of the United States subsequently approved all 26 schedules. As a result of the inventory and scheduling project, all PCC records in all media and formats were covered by approved dispositions and compiled into a comprehensive records manual. Distributed agency-wide in March of 1998, including the agency's intranet, the manual provided clear directions for the appropriate disposition of all the agency's records. Furthermore, it served as a model for the management of records accumulated by the Panamanian government in regards to the canal post-1999. For the most part, the inventory and scheduling project went very well. However, I did encounter one obstacle. A small controversy developed following a visit that I made to Panama in February of 1995 to provide an on-site appraisal and scheduling assistance to PCC regarding a large collection of unscheduled engineering, architectural, and cartographic records. While there, I conducted a detailed analysis of the records and assisted PCC records management staff in developing a schedule covering 62 series of cartographic and engineering records. Seven of those series pertain to historically important drawings and maps. The schedule designated these seven series for transfer to the National Archives where they would be adequately preserved. One series in particular that NARA was especially interested in covered approximately 8,000 drawings accumulated by the Isthmian Canal Commission relating to the construction of such things as locks, piers, dams, buildings, equipment, boats, and other canal operating and residential facilities. The bulk of these drawings encompassed the period 1904 through 1914, but a small amount dated to 1899, the French era. The ICC drawings were of special interest to NARA, as I had mentioned, and they constituted the single most important series of drawings documenting the construction of the canal and its associated equipment and structures. Inasmuch as the drawings contained a tremendous amount of historical value, they were scheduled for permanent retention and transfer to the National Archives. NARA was extremely interested in accessioning these drawings into its holdings, where they would receive state-of-the-art temperature, humidity controls, environmental controls, as well as fire protection and other steps necessary to provide for their preservation. At the time, the drawings were stored in the attic of PCC's administration building. And the environmental controls in the attic were just deplorable. The attic was damp, musty, insect infestation, vermin. It was just terrible environmental conditions to store these historical records. And the original paper and linen drawings wrapped in wooden rolls were brittle and in an advanced state of deterioration. It was therefore necessary to get these drawings back to NARA's preservation lab in the U.S. where they could be repaired and stabilized. The schedule that was drafted provided for the microfilming of the seven series of maps and drawings. As stipulated in the schedule, the original hard copies were to be designated for transfer to the holdings of the National Archives, while the microfilm copies were to remain in Panama for ongoing canal operations. The Archivist of the United States approved the schedule on March the 4th, 1996. Consequently, to my dismay, PCC submitted a revised schedule to NARA 8 months later in November of 1996. The revised schedule, which superseded the previous one that the Archivist had signed months earlier, called for the original hard copies to remain in Panama while the microfilm copies were to be transferred to the National Archives. Officials with the government of Panama did not want the original drawings to leave the country for three reasons. First, many of the drawings pertaining to the structure of the lock walls were still in use for current operations, and revisions were still being made to these drawings. Secondly, whenever possible, engineers like working with original drawings, so we've been told. And third, the Panama Canal is considered part of Panama's heritage as well, and the Republic of Panama wanted the original drawings documenting the canal's construction to remain in the country. PCC explained at the time that a new Panama Canal Museum and Archives was being established in Panama, and the maps and drawings were expected to be deposited there. Furthermore, the facility was expected to have the latest environmental controls. While the most preferable situation would have been for NARA to receive the original drawings, it became increasingly evident the Panamanian officials would not allow the drawings to leave Panama. To make matters more difficult, a Panamanian national, as provided for by the 1977 treaty, now headed the Panama Canal Commission. This was sort of a unique situation, for it was the first time that a non-U.S. citizen actually headed an agency of the U.S. government. And at this point, time was running out for U.S. control over the canal, and there was no time for a prolonged political or diplomatic dispute with the government of Panama that would most likely have lasted beyond 1999. So, actually, I was part diplomat and part archivist at the time, I guess, dealing with the Panamanian government as well. And so, therefore, NARA concluded that the most prudent course of action would be for the microfilm copies to be deposited in the National Archives and the hard copies to remain in Panama for ongoing operations. And the revised schedule was subsequently approved by the Archivist of the United States on September 18th of 1997. NARA now has in its holdings approximately 1,800 cubic feet of records under Record Group 185 that documents the construction, operation, and administration of the Panama Canal, as well as the former Panama Canal Zone government. However, the records document more than just a canal. They document a way of life. They tell a story of thousands of Americans who were born, worked, and died in the Canal Zone. Thank you.
Good evening to all. Buenas tardes a todos. The essence of the political document creation and organization has always been the legitimization of the governing powers. In the process of doing so, Spain proclaimed regulations for the Archivo de Simancas in 1588. In 1790, the Archivo General de Indias organized its documents according to the different crown dependencies in which the empire was organized. 2 years later, in 1792, the Archivo General de la Nueva España was created. Puerto Rico, its colony since 1493, had no centralized archive, but all the institutions of the Spanish crown in Puerto Rico had offices where the documents were kept following the organization of legajos, as it was known. Obviously, original and copies of documents created by officials in Puerto Rico, San Juan Bautista de Puerto Rico, as it was in the beginning known, were sent in ships, armadas, to the different authorities of the Spanish regime, Consejo de Indias, Casa de la Contratación, etc. One of the oldest documents in the General Archive of Puerto Rico is the Actas del Cabildo de San Juan. That is the document to the left side of the screen. This document is of 1730. It's the agreement or acuerdos of the local municipality. When the invasion forces of the U.S. Army took control of the island in 1898, many documents were destroyed or taken by the Spanish Army. We have also here part of the other document, oldest one, the Protocolo of 1751, or the Registry of Notarial Deeds, the notary being Juan B. Núñez. As we can see, it's only part of the document. It is also preserved in an old process called lamination that was invented by Barrow. When the invasion forces of the U.S. Army took control of the island in 1898, many documents, as I said, were destroyed or taken by the Spanish Army. Those that remain in the island are described in the report of the U.S. Evacuation Commission by Charles W. Russell, which is Exhibit 2 of the report of the Military Governor of Puerto Rico on Civil Affairs submitted by George W. Davis. It states the condition of the island from October 18, 1898, till April 30, 900. El informe Davis, as it is referred to by Puerto Rican historians, describes the existence and conditions of archives of departmental offices of the Spanish government on the island. The report emphasizes that there is an absence of documents of the first century of the colonization of Puerto Rico due to the many invasions of the capital, especially by the English in 1595, George Clifford, Earl of Cumberland, and later in 1625 by Balduino Enrico, we call the Dutch, Balduin Enrique, which burned and destroyed the city. Also, the climate and insects had caused great destruction of the historical Spanish documents. The documents that remain in Puerto Rico after the Spanish-American War, as stated by Article 8 of the Treaty of Paris, signed by Spain and the USA, ending the hostilities, indicated that all the archives and official register will remain in the hands of the winning party, and that winning party should take care of the all the documents. A renowned Puerto Rican, Cayetano Colitoste, was assigned to prepare an inventory of the documents that were not needed in the island for the understanding of the administrative organization of the government. These documents were sent to the Division of Manuscripts in the Library of Congress. Eventually, the superintendent of the Division of Manuscripts, Herbert Friedenwald, determined to remain only one-third of the documents and the remaining should be sent back to Puerto Rico due to their administrative value. These boxes were wrongly labeled and sent to Cuba, where they remained in the Havana harbor and were exposed to a hurricane. The documents that remain in the Library of Congress were transferred in 1943 to the National Archive, where they were still until 1973, when they were sent to the General Archive of Puerto Rico. That day, because in that day we have the building that we are, that is our site today. These documents were organized here in the state and are known as Record Group 186, Records of the Spanish Governors of Puerto Rico. Here in screen, we see part of the original of the inventory that Colentoste made. It is on what we call now Fondo Capitanía General. In 1903, the local legislature created the figure of the official historian of Puerto Rico, and Cayetano Colitoste is appointed as the first official historian. The Historical Archive of Puerto Rico is created on June 20 to save, keep, arrange, classify, and catalog all the documents belonging to the Spanish agencies that were no longer functioning or that were suppressed. The official historian becomes the first director of the Historical Archive. The archive was installed in an impressive building in the main avenue of the capital city, center of all major government dependencies. This building will prove to be inadequate due to electrical failures, moth, and what we call comején, it's termites, and rain filtrations. The documents were stored in the basement. In 1926, a fire destroyed great part of the holdings of the archive. The surviving documents remain in a room at the Casino de Puerto Rico, a majestic building that still stands near the Tapia Theater in Old San Juan. In 1946, the holdings of the archive were transferred to the newly created Department of History of the University of Puerto Rico at Río Piedras, where they remain until 1955. Public Law 5 of December 8, 1955, as amended, is the Public Document Administration Act. It is the law that specifies what is a public document, who should take care of it, and how the archive will take care of the documents. But this law has a lot of amendments and has proved to be old and not a really... well-defined for a 21st century archive. The law says that all Spanish documents and public documents older than 50 years should be sent to the archive. Also, that all notarial register from 60 years older should also be sent to the archive. In the case of the notarial documents, the Tribunal Supremo de Puerto Rico, that will be the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico, remains at the legal custody of the documents. So the archive only give reference over these documents, but has no power to certify the notarial deeds. I want to take a moment to go over the general archive sections. Even though the archive is established as the official depository of all public and private documents, the archive is under the administrative under the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture. So we are a dependent agency of another agency. The law also establishes that the archive should have a reproduction and restoration lab, a thing that we have not had since its creation. So what resources do the archive have? I first want to talk a little bit about the concept of the repository. The archive can be seen only by some people as the building, but the archive, it's a combination of the documents, the people that work in them, and the conservation conditions that the building should have. For the past 26 years, the concept of the repository has only been the building. What is happening to the building, not what is happening to the documents, what is happening to the people, to the educational capabilities that are being offered to the archivist. When the archive was created in 1958, the employees were not cataloged as, were not named archivists. They were named historical investigators, because the idea was that the documents of the Spanish regime were to be described and organized so that investigations at the University of Puerto Rico could be handed out. So when Aurelio Tanodi, the renowned archivist of Argentina, visited the archive in 1967, he made a report of the conditions of the archive, and one of the things that he mentioned was the archive needed to professionalize its people. Right now, the professional formation is one of the things that the archive is really in a need. Tanodi's recommendation also emphasized the method for organizing and cataloging the different holdings, the historical documents of the Spanish regime and the contemporary documents of the institutions of the Commonwealth. Right now, the budget for the archive, as it is stated on screen, is only $185,000. It is divided by that way from the budget of the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture, $85,000, and from a special assignment of the legislature, $1,000. The air conditioning system, the support of the air conditioning system, has more budget than the one that has been assigned for all the things that the archive has to do. So we will get to that later on. Okay. From 1999 till 2004, the archive was undergoing what was called the Plan Maestro de Reformas. It was a fantasy kind of restoration thing, because we have been waiting for restoration since 1984. That was the year that I entered as an archivist to the archives. So we had this huge restoration project, and we were divided in two groups. So we started like a nomad kind of life. But still, we can see here, we opened the facilities again on 2006. We have here some of the statistics that prove the access or the gestión de usuarios that we have. We have the new access and legal claims. The legal claims are the mandatory things that we have to do with people that come to the archive to see documents, to follow legal procedures. So we cannot say, even though we are under restoration or whatever, that we cannot give access to people to documents. In the year 2004-2005, we had 2,137 visitors. And the next year, because the reference room was closed, we have only 434. The next year, we have 2,450, and 207 and 208, we have 2,452. On the year 2008, it's a very sad year for us because we were closed because of the heating and the air conditioning system broke down, and we were all summer until March of the next year closed. So right now, until this moment, we have had 3,282 people as new access and legal claim researchers. Pretty much the categories of the researchers are defining here. We have 33% that will be students. These students will be from different majors, not only in local universities. We will have people coming from Spain, from different countries. We have agencies that will be 8%, excuse me. We have 18% that will be others, that will be people that come to the main reference room but maybe should be going to other divisions of the archive or to other agencies. Then we have what we call genealogists, legal claims, and bona fide researchers that will be people that are our usual investigators. Okay, this is just a site of the main reference room and some of the most widely used documents. There is a reproduction of a historic map of the town of Isabela. This is a composition of a document of a slave and the tag that was put around his. These are documents related to the Partido Popular Democrático. Here you see the challenges that we are facing. This is the moving image archive. Some statistics of the reference service and screening that is done on the moving image archive. The sound and music archive, where we have done projects for the digitalization of sound recordings. Reel-to-reel recordings. Photographic division, where we have the most digitized and automatized records. Okay, and before leaving, I just want to take some time to talk rapidly. This is the facade of the building. It was construction done the last construction, big construction done under the Spanish regime. It was designated to be and projected to be a hospital, Hospital Civil de la Capital. It was then used as a correctional facility. It was built in 1887, the architect being Domingo Sesmero. I say there a professional education, the Puerto Rico dilemma. We are pleased to know that the Fundación Puerto Rico of ex-Governor Felisa Sila M. Calderón has received a funding for a survey of the Puerto Rican professional education needs. We have here the director of the archive, Jose Ortiz, among us. We have been receiving funds from Spain, from the Programa de Ayuda al Desarrollo de los Archivos Iberoamericanos, the Spain-ADAI partnership. We have had 53 projects between the dates stated. And right now we are facing the dilemma of, do we need to amend this law that has handicapped the process of administrating the public documents in Puerto Rico, or do we need a new law? Right now, because of the government reduction policy, the archive has only 8 archivists, the director and myself, 2 technicians, one in the moving image division and one in the photographic area, and only one person that is the document restorator, but he has no lab, and that is it. So we are facing a situation that has been very difficult for us, but we, as you have seen in the charts, we are committed to service. Good evening, and thanks a lot.
So three very different islands and land masses, three very different archival collections, but some very similar problems stemming from the fact that these are in some part foreign records, in some part local records, in some part federal records in one case as well. We have issues of difficulty of where the record should reside. We have challenges of language. We have challenges even of archaic handwriting, in some cases acting as a barrier to that information. And who's making the decisions about these records, where they should reside and who should keep them, and how they're going to be developed. Milagros brought us into the 20th century with the kinds of issues that a lot of us are facing now with our own archives, whether they be local, federal, historical societies or whatever. We're all being hit by the economic challenges. So what questions do you all have, or comments about the presentations? And if you would use the mic in the center of the room, your comments can then be recorded and we won't have to repeat the questions. So please feel free to step up to the mic if you have any questions or observations. And I'll get started with the questions. And I was wondering what kind of training they had, Tom, when they handed over the records. What kind of training was offered to the Panamanian government, or did they demand in order to take care of the records? You can just use the mic on the table.
Can everyone hear me? Many of the Panamanian Panama Canal Commission staff, records management staff, actually sent their staff to the National Archives and attended several of our records management training classes. The Panamanian government also, in preparation for the transition, they sent several of their employees to the National Archives for records management training. So when the canal transferred legal custody to the Republic of Panama, they would be up and running, and they would have a good knowledge of records management training once that occurred in 1999. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? I know we're the last session, but I know that people have questions. Do any of the commentators or our panelists have questions that they'd like to ask of each other, or comments they would like to make before we close the session? No?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. You mentioned, this is for the Panama Canal Zone presentation, that there was some resistance to one series of records being transferred, and as a result of that disagreement about where those records should be, the disposition was switched up. Was there any instance of other series of records facing that same kind of question, and did the National Archive make adjustments in those instances as well?
Yes, we were, as you know, as I mentioned, we were extremely interested in the construction drawings, and we did resolve the issue on that. NARA did not receive the hard copy originals, which we had hoped for, but our main concern as an archivist, I just wanted to make sure that the records were preserved, and the Panamanian government has assured us that they were building a modern state-of-the-art facility, archives facility, where the records would be adequately preserved. As far as the other historical records, there were several other series that we were interested in, as well as the Panamanians. They needed many of the historical records that we wanted to bring back to the National Archives because it documented U.S. involvement in Panama. But the Republic of Panama also wanted those records because of ongoing operations. And there was a study done by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. They went down there and they looked at a lot of these records, and they felt like what probably should happen would be for the historical series to be microfilmed as well. But there was some disagreement. We're talking a huge amount of money, and there was some disagreement who would pay for it. The Panamanian government wanted the U.S. government to pay for it, and there was a stalemate, and those records were never microfilmed. They were brought back to the United States. And the archives, the National Archives in Washington, is available to any Panamanian official who wants to come up here and look at some of those records.
Thanks.
Just tagging off of that, before I get to your question, Marisol, we had a similar issue for the Danish records of the Virgin Islands as well. Not so much a conflict, because it was actually left to others to come in and take the initiative. So in 1934 when Larson came, something like that?
36.
When he came, many of the records had been taken with the Danes when they left in 1917, 1918, when they did their first shipments, but a lot remained behind, and no one was doing anything with them because we were under the administration of the Department of the Navy at the time. This Danish archivist comes, he makes his decision on arrangements and what should go and what should stay, and there really was no conflict about it at all. Fast forward now to the very culture-conscious 1990s, and now many people in the islands, especially those who are descendants of the enslaved populations, are saying, you've taken our heritage, you've taken our culture. We have no documentary evidence with which to do research on where we came from, and we want it back. I'll show you where it will go and why it's not coming back soon anyway. But the problem is that we haven't had any kind of continuing care for the records that remain in the Virgin Islands. And that's what one of our storage facilities looked like when I came aboard in 2008, and it had stayed that way for probably up to 20 years with things just on the shelf. Now, we've all seen this. I mean, I love these conferences because I learned that I'm not the only one going through this, but it was still heartbreaking when I first came on. There hadn't been an archivist for 15 years, and prior to that, there was only one for 3 years who was borrowed from one of the regional NARA offices to work in the Virgin Islands. So we've got a lot of work cut out for us, but we're not getting the records back if we don't have a place to put them. They're very safe in Denmark, and Lord knows they're safe at College Park, but we need intellectual access to them. I don't know if you have the same issues, Milagros, with records that are abroad that you would like to have brought back to Puerto Rico. Can you use the microphone?
With the documents that are in Spain, we have no problems because we understand that those are documents of the Spanish crown when they were governing their colony of Puerto Rico. But we have documents of Puerto Rico that are under the insular Bureau, Documents of Puerto Rico.
For the Department of Interior.
The Department of the Interior, and we have had people that come to the archive thinking that they have been transferred or at least digitized or something. It is not only for the people that live in Puerto Rico. We have more Puerto Ricans outside of the island than in the island, so they are entitled to have access to the documents that are in the National Archive in the different divisions. We know that this will be on on New York because that is the area where the federal government has the documents related to Puerto Rico. But there has been no cooperation in that sense between the federal government and the archive.
It's a difficult situation. Marisol, you had a question.
Well, comments and question. Number one, thank you so much for coming here, especially Milagros, because I know that it was an adventure to get her here. You know, the support is not as good. We assume that, you know, professional development is something that we'll get, and it's, as we know, that not everybody has been. And we're really glad that she's here and also to learn what's going on in Virgin Islands and Panama. So I'm really happy that this is happening today. And the question I have for Milagros is maybe she can develop a little more about the educational needs of archivists in Puerto Rico. What is the situation now, and what would you hope would be an improvement on training archivists in Puerto Rico to work either in the archives or other archives later?
Because Puerto Rico functions with a law that is Ley de Administración de Documentos or Administration of Document Administration Act. We need also to educate what we call the document administrators. That will be the people, the record managers, that will be the people that will be in the agencies, in the government dependencies. I just want to take a few seconds to read some statistics that were part of the last Puerto Rico State Historical Record Advisory Board. It is a document as of 1990. The results of a survey in the Executive Branch Document Administration Program. 45% of the agencies do not have record managers. 76 do not have document retention plan. 25 do not have written procedures for conservation and disposition of documents. 32% has not done a disposition of documents. 46% do not have a central archive for active documents. 28% of the facilities do not have temperature control. 63% do not have fire sprinkle or fire alarm. And 59% do not have an insect or fungus extermination plan. So it is not only the education in the sense of how do you organize or how do you get to know what is a permanent document. It is also that you have a lot of agencies with what will be historical documents with them. And if a disaster comes, we have a lot of fronts to deal with, not only the problems in the archive, but also the problems in the different agencies.
Paul, did you want anything to say? You want to add anything? To that, I would just add that the Virgin Islands has almost 100% on those statistics, so we have no temperature control, and we have no retention schedules and no records management program whatsoever, but we're getting there. We're going step by step. Any other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. We have time for one more.
Thank you all. It's been very interesting, this panel. I have a question, I suppose, especially for Milagros. Is the status such that you can appeal for grants to develop programs for whatever area you wish to focus on from NARA even or from NHPRC or a United States agency or the ICA, the International Council of Archives?
We cannot I think so, that was explained early in the morning, Susan. We cannot have grants to the National Historic Preservation.
NHPRC, you can. You can, but they prefer that you have a SHRAB, and there's no SHRAB as in the Virgin Islands. We don't have one right now, although they've been very gracious and said, look, we'll deal with that. Go ahead and get the grant. And then hopefully we can use that to leverage. That's what we're thinking, or I'm thinking, no, don't tell anyone, that in the Virgin Islands, if I get a grant, we'll just leverage it to get a SHRAB going, because that's the only thing we can. We got our SHRAB grant, and I'll tell tales out of school, but we got a SHRAB grant, and our government commissioner. My commissioner turned it down. And I'm told by Kathleen Williams, we're the only government that she knows of that has ever turned back money to, because they just didn't want to deal with it. So I have a lot of schooling to do. But that's one opening. And then I don't know if you've experienced it, but it's difficult to qualify for foreign grants because they consider us the U.S., but we're not the U.S. when we talk to the U.S. people. So I don't know if you've encountered that.
In the case of Puerto Rico, we have had some funding done with the National Film Preservation Foundation for the restoration of a film that was, I don't know if it was 202 or whatever. We have also had a funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Great.
And we have been dealing with the partnership with Spain because the ADAI program has projects that can be worked on small period of time. And we can bring this alternative to other institutions, cultural and historical institutions that might not have too many people to work out a very specialized, technically difficult to write in English.
And we do also have a connection with the Panama Canal in the Virgin Islands, as Puerto Rico probably does too, where a lot of people from the Virgin Islands left to go work in the Panama Canal zone, and so many of our histories are there as well. And now, question, are they in Panama? Are they in the National Archives? And how do we get to them? So that's one of the holes that we have to fill, yes. And Paul's going to answer that question.
Well, I could just add something to that. I think that in Washington terms, things get done when people have clout to get them done.
That's a good point.
And the Virgin Islands has no clout in Washington. And if there were to be some kind of groundswell of support from archivists or Virgin Islanders or something, perhaps this could get done. In the meantime, you're just dependent on archivists, professional archivists, supposedly doing their jobs here in Washington. I guess.
Please leave your names and emails at the door and we'll contact you. If there are no more questions, I just wanted to sum up by saying that on behalf of LACHA, the roundtable that sponsored this proposal, and also thanks to the government records section of SAA, which endorsed the session, I just want you to join me in thanking our panelists once again, and we thank you for your participation and attendance today. And with that, we are adjourned.